Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Hey, it's Tony Bruschi from Dark Side of Wikipedia. After a year of doing this show and you guys loving it, we've created a way to give you even more Dark Side content. How? By you becoming a Dark Sider. That's a supporter of the Dark Side of Wikipedia. When you become a Dark Sider, you get advanced access to our episodes months before they're released to the public. So if you want more to binge away on, this is the way to get it. In addition to the advanced episodes, you also get our archive of episodes, and all of it is commercial free. So if you like the show and you want to listen without the pesky commercials, become a Dark Sider. In addition to all of that, we're also now giving final chapters to all of our new episodes. That means you get to hear an extra chapter of the story and discussion, usually an extra 15, 20, 25 minutes of content for each episode that we're calling the final chapter, which is exclusively for Darksider members. The reality is, this show is not free for us to create. It takes a lot of time, effort, and money to put it together. So if you'd like to be part of the Dark Side of Wikipedia, support us and keep us on the air, and in exchange, get all of those extras, please become a Darksider. Do it by signing up at patreon.com/darksideofwikipedia, or go to our website, darksideofwiki.com, and click Become a Darksider. It's only $5 a month, and you get access to everything I just talked about. Check it out today, patreon.com/darksideofwikipedia, or go to our website, darksideofwiki.com, and click Become a Darksider, and help keep Dark Side of Wikipedia alive. Three teens involved in a murder as part of a sadistic, satanic ritual. It seems like something out of a horror movie or a bizarre Netflix series. But in 1993, it was all too real. The story playing out amongst the residents of Memphis, Tennessee. It would end with three teens convicted for the murder. But were they guilty? Or was it part of a mob needing to find a perpetrator for horrific crime?
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into a reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is the Dark Side of Wikipedia.
The West Memphis Three are three men convicted as teenagers in 1994 of the 1993 murders of three boys in West Memphis, Arkansas. Damian Eccles was sentenced to death. Jesse Biscelli Jr. to life imprisonment plus 2 20-year sentences, and Jason Baldwin to life imprisonment. During the trial, the prosecution asserted that the juveniles killed the children as part of a satanic ritual. Due to the dubious nature of the evidence, as well as the suspected presence of emotional bias in court, the case garnered widespread controversy and was the subject of several documentaries. Celebrities and musicians held fundraisers to support efforts to free the men. In July 2007, new forensic evidence was presented. A report jointly issued by the state and the defense team stated, although most of the genetic material recovered from the scene was attributable to the victims of the offenses, some of it cannot be attributed to either the victims or the defendants. following a 2010 decision by the Arkansas Supreme Court regarding newly produced DNA evidence and potential juror misconduct, the West Memphis Three negotiated a plea bargain with prosecutors. On August 19, 2011, they entered Elford pleas, which allowed them to assert their innocence while acknowledging that prosecutors have enough evidence to convict them. Judge David Lasser accepted the pleas and sentenced the three to time served. They were released with 10-year suspended sentences, having served 18 years. On May 5, 1993, three 8-year-old boys, Steve Branch, Michael Moore, and Christopher Byers, were reported missing in West Memphis, Arkansas. The first report to the police was made by the boys' adoptive father, John Mark Byers, around 7 p.m. The boys were allegedly last seen together by three neighbors who, in affidavits, told of seeing them playing together around 6:30 p.m. the evening they disappeared and seeing Terry Hobbs, Steve Branch's stepfather, calling them to come home. Initial police searches made that night were limited. Friends and neighbors also conducted a search that night, which included a cursory visit to the location where the bodies were later found. A more thorough police search for the children began around 8 a.m. on May 6, led by the Crittenden County Search and Rescue personnel. Searchers canvassed all of West Memphis, but focused primarily on Robin Hood Hills, where the boys were reportedly last seen. Despite a shoulder-to-shoulder search of Robin Hood Hills by a human chain, researchers and searchers found no signs of the missing boys. Around 1:45 p.m., juvenile parole officer Steve Jones spotted a boy's back shoe floating in a muddy creek that led to a major drainage canal in Robin Hood Hills. A subsequent search of the ditch revealed the bodies of three boys. They'd been stripped naked and were hog-tied with their own shoelaces. Their right ankles tied to their right wrist behind their backs. The same with their left arms and legs. Their clothing was found in the creek, some of it twisted around sticks that had been thrust into the muddy ditch bed. The clothing was mostly turned inside out. Two pairs of the boys' underwear were never recovered. Christopher Byers had lacerations to various parts of his body and mutilation of his scrotum and penis. The autopsies by forensic pathologist Frank J. Peretti indicated that Byers died of multiple injuries, while Moore and Branch died of multiple injuries with drowning. Police initially suspected the boys had been raped. However, later expert testimony disputed this finding. Trace amounts of sperm DNA were found on a pair of pants recovered from the scene. Prosecution experts claim Byers' wounds were the results of a knife attack. He'd been purposely castrated by the murderer. Defense experts claim the injuries were most likely the result of post-mortem animal predators. Police believe the boys were assaulted and killed at the location where they were found. Critics argued that the assault, at least, was unlikely to have occurred at the creek. Byers was the only victim with drugs in his system. He was prescribed Ritalin in January of 93 as part of a treatment for an attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. The initial autopsy report describes the drug and the dosage as a subtherapeutic level. His father said Byers may not have taken his prescription on May 5th, 1993. So it's a very, very dark story here today of the dark side of Wikipedia, of the West Memphis Three. If you like our program and you want access to not only the final chapter of this episode, but all of the episodes that have final chapters or advanced episodes, go check out our Patreon page, patreon.com/darksideofwikipedia, or our website, darksideofwiki, and click there to get access to all that and help support the program. Press subscribe wherever you download the podcast as well. Tony and Sean with you on the episode today. It's a case where people were accused of something that they did not do. I'm interested to hear how involved they were to the point where they actually gave the death sentence to one of the kids, or one of not one of the murdered children, but one of the accused perpetrators, and just how convincing was the evidence that they got it that far. And of course, we'll get into that. What are your thoughts thus far?
Very interesting. Equally as interesting, when's the last time you met an 8-year-old Steve?
An 8-year-old Steve. I think that's a name. You know, you'll meet a lot of Steves that are between the ages of about 40 and 70 now.
Yeah.
But you'll probably meet none that are under that age, or very, very few.
Oh, what a beautiful little baby boy. What's his name? Owen Landon Langston. Steve. His name's Steve. He's 6 months old. Oh, what's your son's name? Mike. Oh, what's your son's name? Chris. Okay. All of your boys are going to grow up to be lovely insurance agents. no clue how, what I'm interested to find out is how they connected them to it. This yeah. seems extremely horrific and tragic, but what, you got a shoulder to shoulder search, you come up with no clues, nothing. How then do you connect the dots of these three others who were imprisoned? Mm-hmm. To taking the lives of these three boys.
Yeah, it's it is one of those things where how did somebody do this? Why did somebody do this? And that's, you know, I believe this case is still unsolved, if I'm correct. But we'll dive more into that. Let's step into the area of the initial look at suspects in the case of the West Memphis Three. At the time of their arrest, Jesse Miss Kelly Jr. was 17 years old, Jason Baldwin was 16 years old, and Damian Eccles was 18 years old. Baldwin and Eccles had been previously arrested for vandalism and shoplifting, respectively, and Miss Kelly had a reputation for his temper and for engaging in fistfights with other teenagers at school. Miss Kelly and Eccles had dropped out of high school. However, Baldwin earned high grades and demonstrated a talent for drawing and sketching and was encouraged by one of his teachers to study graphic design in college. Eccles and Baldwin were close friends and bonded over their similar tastes in music and fiction, over their shared distaste for the prevailing culture climate of West Memphis, situated in the Bible Belt. Baldwin and Eccles were acquainted with Miss Kelly from school, but were not close friends with him. Eccles' family was poor and received frequent visits from social workers, and he rarely attended school. He and a girlfriend had run off and later broken into a trailer during a rainstorm. They were arrested, though only Eccles was charged with burglary. Eccles spent several months in a mental institution in Arkansas and afterwards received full disability status from the Social Security Administration. During Eccles' trial, Dr. George W. Woods testified for the defense that Eccles suffered from serious mental illness characterized by grandiose and persecutory delusions, auditory and visual hallucinations, disorders, and thought processes, substantial lack of insight, and chronic incapacitating mood swings. At his death penalty sentencing hearing, Eccles' psychologist report that months before the murders, Eccles had claimed that he obtained superpowers by drinking human blood. At the time of his arrest, Eccles was working part-time at a roofing company and expecting a child with his girlfriend. Early in their investigation, the WMPD briefly regarded two West Memphis teenagers as suspects, Chris Morgan and Brian Holland. Both with drug offense histories, they abruptly departed for Oceanside, California, 4 days after the bodies were discovered. Morgan was presumed to be at least casually familiar with all three murdered boys, having previously driven an ice cream truck route in their neighborhood. Arrested in Oceanside on May 17, 1993, Morgan and Holland both took polygraph exams administered by California police. Examiners reported that both men's charts indicated deception when they denied involvement in the murders. During subsequent questioning, Morgan claimed a long history of drug and alcohol use, along with blackouts and memory lapses. He claimed that he might have killed the victims, but quickly recanted this part of his statement. California police sent blood and urine samples from Morgan and Holland to the WMPD, but there's no indication WMPD investigated Morgan or Holland as suspects following their arrest in California. The relevance of Morgan's recanted statement would later be debated in trial, but it was eventually barred from admission as evidence. Then there's Mr. Bojangles. The sighting of a black male as a possible alternate suspect was implied during the beginning of the Miss Kelly trial. According to local West Memphis police officers, on the evening of May 5, 1993, at 8:42 p.m., workers in the Bojangles restaurant, located about a mile from the crime scene in Robin Hood Hills, reported seeing a black male who seemed mentally disoriented inside the restaurant's ladies' room. The man was bleeding and had brushed against the restroom walls. Officer Regina Meeks responded to the call, taking the restaurant manager's report through the eatery's drive-through window. By then, the man had left, and police did not enter the restroom on that date. The day after the victims' bodies were found, Bojangles' manager, Marty King, thinking there was a possible connection to the bloody man found in the bathroom, reported the incident to police officers, who then inspected the ladies' room. King gave the officers a pair of sunglasses he thought the man had left behind, and the detectives took some blood samples from the walls and tiles of the restroom. Police Detective Brian Ridge testified that he later lost those blood scrapings. A hair identified as belonging to a black male was later recovered from a sheet wrapped around one of the victims. Evidence in interviews, police officers James Sudbury and Steve Jones felt that the crime had cult overtones and that Damien Eccles might be a suspect because he had an interest in occultism, and Jones felt Eccles was capable of murdering children. The police interviewed Eccles on May 7th, 2 days after the bodies were discovered. During a polygraph examination, he denied any involvement. The polygraph examiner claimed that Eccles' chart indicated deception. On May 9th, during a formal interview by Detective Brian Ridge, Eccles mentioned that one of the victims has wounds to the genitals. Law enforcement viewed this knowledge as incriminating. After a month had passed with little progress in the case, police continued to focus their investigation upon Eccles, interrogating him more frequently than any other person. Nonetheless, they claimed he was not regarded as a direct suspect, but a source of information. On June 3rd, the police interrogated Jesse McKelly Jr., despite his reported IQ of 72, categorizing him as borderline intellectually functioning, and his status as a minor. Ms. Kelly was questioned alone. His parents were not present during the interrogation. Ms. Kelly's father gave permission for Ms. Kelly to go with the police, but did not explicitly give permission for his son to be questioned or interrogated. Ms. Kelly was questioned for roughly 12 hours. Only two segments totaling 46 minutes were recorded. Ms. Kelly quickly recanted his confession, citing intimidation, coercion, fatigue, and veiled threats from police. Ms. Kelly specifically said he was scared of the police during his confession. Though he was informed of his Miranda rights, Ms. Kelly later claimed he did not fully understand them. In 1996, the Arkansas Supreme Court ruled that Ms. Kelly's confession was voluntary and that he did, in fact, understand that the Miranda warning and its consequences. Portions of Ms. Kelly's statements to the police were leaked to the press and reported on the front page of the Memphis Commercial Appeal before any of the trials began. Shortly after Ms. Kelly's first confession, police arrested Eccles and his close friend Baldwin. 8 months after his original confession on February 17, 1994, Ms. Kelly made another statement to police. His lawyer, Dan Stidham, remained in the room and continually advised Ms. Kelly not to say anything. Ms. Kelly ignored this advice and went on to detail how the boys were abused and murdered. Stidham, who was later elected to a municipal judgeship, has written a detailed critique of what he asserts are major police errors and misconceptions during their investigation. Stidham made similar comments during a radio show interview in May of 2010. Vicki Hutchinson, a new resident of West Memphis, would play an important role in the investigation, though she would later recant her testimony claiming her statements were fabricated due in part to coercion from police. On May 6, 1993, before the victims were found later the same day, Hutchinson took a polygraph exam by Detective Don Bray at the Marion Police Department to determine whether or not she had stolen money from her West Memphis employer. Hutchinson's young son, Aaron, was also present and proved such a distraction that Bray was unable to administer the polygraph. Aaron, a playmate of the murdered boys, mentioned to Bray that the boys had been killed at the playhouse. When the bodies proved to have been discovered near where Aaron indicated, Bray asked Aaron for further details, and Aaron claimed that he had witnessed the murders committed by Satanists who spoke Spanish. Aaron's further statements were wildly inconsistent, and he was unable to identify Baldwin, Eccles, or Ms. Kelly from photo lineups, and there was no playhouse at the location Aaron indicated. A police officer leaked portions of Aaron's statements to the press, contributing to the growing belief that the murders were part of a satanic rite. On or about June 1, 1993, Hutchinson agreed to police suggestions to place hidden microphones in her home during an encounter with Eccles. Ms. Kelly agreed to introduce Hutchinson to Eccles. During the conversation, Hutchinson reported to Eccles they made no incriminating statements. Police said the recording was inaudible, but Hutchinson claimed the recording was audible. On June 2, 1993, Hutchinson told police that about 2 weeks after the murders were committed, she, Eccles, and Ms. Kelly attended a Wiccan meeting in Terrell, Arkansas. Hutchinson claimed that at the Wiccan meeting, a drunken Eccles openly bragged about killing the three boys. Ms. Kelly was first questioned on June 3, 1993, a day after Hutchinson's purported confession. Hutchinson was unable to recall the Wiccan meeting location and did not name any other participants in the purported meeting. Hutchinson was never charged with theft. She claimed she had implicated Eccles and Ms. Kelly to avoid facing criminal charges and to obtain a reward for the discovery of the murders. Well, that's a good way to get out of, you know, thefts. Blame three kids for murdering three other kids. That seems logical.
So many moving parts with so many possible suspects involved.
Yeah. And it just keeps going and going. Very just disturbing what happened. And it sounds very much like you have a public that's sitting there in a small community wanting answers. They want to know who killed these kids. They wanted to find answers. And the police trying to deliver. And then in some cases, you have that where we got to find somebody. We got to get the blame on somebody. Otherwise, it's going to look like we're not doing our jobs. And you can do your job all you want, but sometimes the evidence just isn't there. But sometimes you get some shady people that are going to try and make it look a certain way. So somebody's the hero, at least, or an answer is given to calm the public down.
Also, I would imagine frustrating when certain suspects, well, I didn't fully understand the Miranda rights, or I was intimidated by my questioning, which I didn't even know that was a thing. You get information, you get a statement, you can use that as evidence, and then ultimately that's tossed out because the possible suspect is playing a victim and felt intimidated. What?
But then
isn't that what is called the... what's it called when you first bring them in and you're being interrogated of sorts?
Mm-hmm. But then you have to look at...
I don't know that there were rules or laws in place that protects the innocent until proven guilty, but protects them from being questioned by law enforcement, whether they feel intimidated or not. I didn't know that there was a law there.
They have
them.
The right to not speak. That's where you have an attorney. But he obviously did have an attorney there, and he still kept speaking. But then you have to look at the fact that most of these were kids. They were still minors, all but one of them.
Sure.
And the IQs of at least one of them in an area that would otherwise at the time be considered, you know, not all mentally there. And this, till today, wouldn't we be considered someone with a disability because of where they're at? So their likelihood to understand those things is something that police have to take into consideration when they interrogate somebody. If the person's not going to be mentally competent to understand these things, you have to take that into consideration. But at the same point, they're trying to find a murderer. And at one moment, they think they got somebody. And then sometimes I think hindsight can be 20/20 as well.
Sometimes there's stories of the Monday morning at work, or maybe the next morning, and you're in the staff kitchen around the water cooler. Man, did I drink too much last night? Oh, yeah, Carl, you got a headache. And oh, man, I just could not sleep. Oh, yeah, when you were drunk last night, you bragged about killing three people. What? Yeah, that knock at the office door. Yeah, that's the police. Shit, I shouldn't have drank that wine.
Yeah.
Next time you have a hangover, hey, could be worse.
It could be worse. You could have bragged about killing someone when you didn't. So just think of it that way. Let's continue on into the trial area. Miss Kelly was tried separately and Eccles and Baldwin were tried together in 1994 under the Burton rule. Miss Kelly's confession could not be admitted against his co-defendants, thus he was tried separately. All three defendants pled not guilty. During Miss Kelly's trial, Richard Offshee, an expert on false confessions and police coercion and professor of sociology at UC Berkeley, testified that the brief recording of Miss Kelly's interrogation was a classic example of police coercion. Critics have also stated that Miss Kelly's various confessions were in many respects inconsistent with each other, as well as with the particulars of the crime scene and murder victims, including, for example, an admission that Miss Kelly watched Damien rape one of the boys. Police had initially suspected that the victims had been raped because their anuses were dilated. However, there was no forensic evidence indicating that the murdered boys had been raped. Dilation of the anus is a normal post-mortem condition. On February 5, 1994, Miss Kelly was convicted by a jury of one count of first-degree murder and two counts of second-degree murder. The court sentenced him to life plus 40 years in prison. His conviction was appealed, but the Arkansas Supreme Court affirmed the conviction. Eccles and Baldwin's trial 3 weeks later. Eccles and Baldwin went on trial. The prosecution accused the three young men of committing a satanic murder. The prosecution called Dale W. Griffiths, a graduate of the unaccredited Columbia Pacific University, as an expert in the occult to testify the murders were a satanic ritual. On March 19, 1994, Eccles and Baldwin were found guilty on 3 counts of murder. The court sentenced Eccles to death and Baldwin to life in prison. At trial, the defense team argued that news articles from the time could have been the source of Eccles' knowledge about the genital mutilation, and Eccles said his knowledge was limited to what was on TV. The prosecution claimed that Eccles' knowledge was nonetheless too close to the facts since there was no public reporting of drowning or that one victim had been mutilated more than others. Eccles testified that Detective Ridge's description of the earlier conversation, which was not recorded regarding those particular details, was inaccurate and indeed that some other claims by Ridge were lies. Mara Leverett, an investigative journalist and author of Devil's Knot, argues that Eccles' information may have come from police leaks, such as Detective Gitchell's comments to Mark Byers that circulated amongst the local public. The defense team objected when the prosecution attempted to question Eccles about his past violent behaviors, but the defense objections were overruled. There's been widespread criticism of how the police handled the crime scene. Ms. Kelly's former attorney, Dan Stidham, cites multiple substantial police errors at the crime scene, characterizing it as literally tampered, especially the creek bed. The bodies, he said, had been removed from the water before the coroner arrived to examine the scene and determine the state of rigor mortis, allowing the bodies to decay on the creek bank and to be exposed to sunlight and insects. The police did not telephone the coroner until almost 2 hours after the discovery of the floating shoe, resulting in a late appearance by the coroner. Officials failed to drain the creek in a timely manner and secure possible evidence in the water. The creek was sandbagged after the bodies were pulled from the water. Stidham calls the coroner's investigation extremely substandard. There was a small amount of blood found at the scene that was never tested. According to HBO's documentary, Paradise Lost, The Child Murders at Robin Hood Hills, and Paradise Lost 2 Revelations, no blood was found at the crime scene, indicating that the location where the bodies were found was not necessarily the location where the murders actually happened. After the initial investigation, the police failed to control disclosure of information and speculation about the crime scene. According to Leverett, police records were a mess. To call them disorderly would be putting it mildly. Leverett speculated that the small local police force was overwhelmed by the crime, which was unlike any they had ever investigated. Police refused an unsolicited offer to aid and consultation from the violent crimes experts of the Arkansas State Police, and critics suggested this was due to the WMPD's being under investigation by the Arkansas State Police for suspected theft from the Crittenden County Drug Task Force. Leverett further noted that some of the physical evidence was stored in paper sacks obtained from a supermarket, with the supermarket's name printed on the bag, rather than the containers of known and controlled origin. When police speculated about the assailant, the juvenile probation officer assisting at the scene of the murder speculated Eccles was capable of committing the murders, stating it looks like Damien Eccles finally killed someone. Brent Turvey, a forensic scientist and criminal profiler, stated in the film Paradise Lost 2 that human bite marks could have been left on at least one of the victims. However, these potential bite marks were first noticed in photography years after the trials were not inspected by a broad certified medical examiner until 4 years after the murders. The defendant's expert testified the mark in question was not an adult bite mark. While experts put on by the state concluded that there was no bite mark at all. The state's experts had examined the actual bodies for any marks, and others conducted expert photo analysis of injuries. Upon further examination, it was concluded that if the marks were bite marks, they did not match the teeth of any of the three convicted. In May of 1994, the three defendants appealed their convictions. The convictions were upheld on direct appeal. In June of 1996, Ms. Kelly's lawyer, Dan Stidham, was preparing to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. In 2007, Eccles petitioned for a retrial based on the statute permitting post-conviction testing of DNA evidence due to technological advances which might provide exoneration for the wrongfully convicted. However, the original trial judge, David Burnett, disallowed presentation of this information in his court. The ruling was, in turn, thrown out by the Arkansas Supreme Court as to all three defendants on November 4th of 2010. John Mark Byers, the adoptive father of victim Christopher Byers, gave a knife to cameraman Doug Cooper, who was working with documentary makers Joe Berlinger and Bruce Sinofsky while filming the first Lost Paradise feature. The knife was a folding hunting knife manufactured by Kershaw. According to the statements given by Berlinger and Sinofsky, Cooper informed them of his receipt of the knife on December 19, 1993, after the documentary crew returned to New York. Berlinger and Sinofsky were reported to have discovered what appeared to be blood on the knife. HBO executives ordered them to return the knife to the West Memphis Police Department. The knife was not received at the West Memphis Police Department until January 8th of 1994. Byers initially claimed the knife had never been used. However, after blood was found on the knife, Byers stated that he had used it only once to cut deer meat. When told the blood matched both his and Chris' blood type, Byers said he had no idea how that blood might have gotten on the knife. During interrogation, West Memphis police suggested to Byers that he might have left the knife out accidentally, and Byers agreed with this. Byers later stated that he may have cut his thumb. Further testing of the knife produced inconclusive results about the source of the blood. Uncertainty remained due to the small amount of blood, and because both John Mark and Byers and Chris Byers had the same HLA-DQ genotype. Byers agreed to and passed a polygraph test about the murders during the filming of Paradise Lost 2 Revelations, but the documentary indicated that Byers was under the influence of several psychoactive prescription medications that could have affected the test results. Following their convictions, Eccles, Miss Kelly, and Baldwin submitted imprints of their teeth. These were compared to the alleged bite marks on Steve Branch's forehead that had not been mentioned in the original autopsy or trial. No matches were found. John Mark Byers and his teeth removed in 1997 after his first trial, but before an imprint could be made. He stated reasons for the removal are apparently contradictory. He claimed both that the seizure medication he was taking caused a disease and that he planned to have the removal because of other kinds of dental problems, which had troubled him for years. After an expert examined autopsy photos and noted what he thought might be the imprint of a belt buckle on Byers' corpse, the elder Byer revealed to the police that he had spanked his stepson shortly before the boy's disappearance. In October of 2003, Vicki Hutchinson, who had played a part in the arrest of Miss Kelly, Eccles, and Baldwin, gave an interview to the Arkansas Times in which she stated that every word she had given to the police was a fabrication. She further asserted that the police had implied that if she did not cooperate with them, they would take away her child. She said that when she visited the police station, employees had photographs of Eccles, Baldwin, and Miss Kelly on the wall and were using them as dart targets. She also claims that an audio tape the police said was unintelligible and they eventually lost was perfectly clear and contained no incriminating statements. In 2007, DNA collected from the crime scene was tested. None was found to match DNA from Eccles, Baldwin, or Miss Kelly. A hair, not inconsistent with Steve Branch's stepfather, Terry Hobbs, was found tied into the knots used to bind one of the victims. The prosecutors, while conceding that no DNA evidence tied to the accused to the crime scene, said the state stands behind its convictions of Eccles and its co-defendants. Pamela Hobbs, May 5, 2009's declaration in the United States District Court of Eastern District of Arkansas, Western Division, indicates that one hair was consistent with the hair of Terry's friend, David Jacoby. Additionally, after the murders, my sister, JoLynn McCauley, and I found in Terry's nightstand a knife that Steve carried with him constantly, and which I had believed was with him when he died. It was a pocket knife that my father had given to Stevie, and Stevie loved that knife. I've been shocked that the police did not find it with Stevie when they found his body. I'd always assumed that my son's murder had taken the knife during the crime. I could not believe it was in Terry's things. He never told me that he had it. Also, my sister JoLynn told me that she saw Terry wash clothes, bed linens, and curtains from Stevie's room at an odd time around the time of the murders. There was additional new evidence discovered in 2007 that I cannot now recall. So things start to get a little bit shady here and a little bit confusing as to what's happening with who did what. And these guys are now behind bars for roughly about 15 years at the point when other evidence and they're starting to dig into things at, you know, 05, 06, 07.
I can't imagine being arrested for something and having to, because these people are in jail throughout, correct?
Yeah. In jail, yeah, one's on death row. Or was.
That has to be infuriating when you didn't do something, and this investigation is continuing, you have to imagine, can't you just find the evidence that allows me to become a free person? I would go, I don't know if I'd be able to stay sane in jail, knowing I didn't do anything.
What kind of risk, you know, is taken then, you know, when the person is innocent and they get out after all those years? I'm not saying that this is a bad thing to find someone innocent after time, but the mental anguish and the torment and the disorders that are probably develop over time being in that sort of a state, I would think that there'd be a high risk that that person's going to get out and probably end up back in very quickly because they're not going to be right. And I think I would have a lot of rage at whoever put me in there. And I think it would take, I don't know what it would take. Obviously, it's hard to put yourself in the shoes of somebody who's not, you know, who has never experienced that. But maybe it's an initial thought. But I think initially I'd be so angry. It would be if they ever let me out, whoever put me in or whoever did this, not necessarily the jurors, but the people who would have, you know, pushed evidence that wasn't factual, it'd be like they're going to pay a price for this. It'd be a big revenge thing, I think.
100%. I think, and obviously everybody not reacting the same way. I think you come out of that with an immense amount of rage, or the extreme opposite. You've just become numb, and you don't really allow anything to show any sense of reactionary. You just become almost a moot, because you get to that certain point that you just almost put a barrier up in your sensory. You get to such a point that you just, I'm good.
Maybe at
the end,
I
can't control this.
Yeah. I mean, it'd be one thing if maybe you were released after 1 year or 2 years, maybe the rage is still there and there's more danger at that point. But if it's like 15, 20 years later, maybe you're just so at peace and you're happy to be out. And I think that's the case with a lot of these guys, because I remember seeing them in one of the documentaries, very just calm, normal guys. And, you know, I'm sure on the inside, there's a lot of damage that's been done. But remarkably, you know, they're not out for blood, it seems. I don't know that I would be that calm. I don't know. I mean, again, it's you wouldn't know unless you're in that situation. It's easy from afar to say, here's what I would do. But until you're there, you know, it's a perspective thing.
I think a final point on that is, rage or not, I would suspect, not having done it, but if one kills another person, clearly that's a pretty big cliff to jump off of. I mean, not everybody is wired to be able to kill someone. So even if you are the most angry and rage and frustration, I'd like to think there's someone that could kill another person on purpose. I'd like to think that even the most angry individual could not kill a person on purpose. So even if they have so much rage, you know, they'll be really angry, but to not take it out on actually taking another person's life.
Yeah. It's a messed up story, and it continues. In our final chapter, we're going to go into the jury misconduct and what ultimately happens to the West Memphis Three. If you want to hear it, become a Darksider and get the final chapter of this episode, go to patreon.com/darksideofwikipedia or our website, Darkside of Wiki, and click Become a Darksider. You'll get access to the rest of this, the final chapter, as well as all of our final chapters and advanced episodes of the show released to you months before everybody else, so you can binge away on our show all you want, all the true crime you can eat, essentially. It is a buffet of disturbing shit. Again, patreon.com/darksideofwikipedia to get in on that. Sean and myself will see you on the final chapter of The Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments. River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.